Whoa, a hush fell over the crowd.
Look up my Facebook page.
My name is John Beck, and I'm the director of the Labor Education Program here at Michigan State, which is one of the joint parts of what's called our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, a program that we run with the MSU Museum. And our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives looks at the intersection of culture and work, broadly defined. We do film openings, concerts. We're going into the 18th year of our Brown Bag series. And we're very happy to be in a cooperative relationship with the MSU Library on a number of different programs, like tonight's rock star worthy appearance by Ben Hamper. Ben Hamper kind of exploded on the scene and became, for many people, the idea of what a factory worker was if that factory worker happened to write as a combination of say, John Steinbeck on the one side, perhaps a little bit of Jack Kerouac, and a whole lot of Ken Kesey, among others. His book, Rivethead, did a number of different things for America. Number one, it created one of the finest pieces of required literature at many colleges and universities now across the land. It gave us a brand new word, rivethead, which I think became one of the iconic words for understanding the experience of factory workers. And I think what Ben really did best is he unlocked the door of the American factory so that people could actually peer inside. Peer inside in a very poignant way. There are many passages within Rivethead that are just unbelievably emotional for many people. On the other side, some of the funniest prose ever written in the form of a memoir. Probably many people think of it as fine fiction, except for the fact that all of those words come out of Ben Hamper's experience at a truck and bus in Flint. Now, any of you who have read Rivethead really have no need of introduction of Ben Hamper. For those of you who have never read Ben Hamper, really, you know, think, who is this man? I can only tell you that he is his own best introduction. So with that, please join me in welcoming to Michigan State University, Ben Hamper. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, John. Ooh, a lot of people here. It's been a while since I've done this, so a tad bit nervous. Thanks to John. Thanks to Michael Rodriguez, wherever he is. Where'd he go? And the other gentleman I met, John, also, thank you for bringing me here. Spoke a few times back, like 15 years ago here, and it was always an enjoyable experience. First of all, is Mike Vincent here? There you are. I thought I would be able to pick you out better, but Bigfoot's in the house. Yeah, it's sort of ironic that I got into writing because I didn't like to talk to people, and it's led to this. So we'll do the best we can. Is anybody going to be too disappointed if I don't read from Rivethead right off the bat? I'm going to read I've sort of become the go-to guy for any books about factories or cars, so I've written a lot of introductions. And this is one I wrote for a book that was part of the Guggenheim Museum over there in Germany. An artist named Phoebe Washburn wrote this book and had a big a visual collage thing called Regulated Fool's Melt Meadow. And they asked me to write a sort of a piece that would describe, give the flavor of the inside of a factory. And this is how it went. Until the day I hired into the factory, I had a fair disdain for factory workers. Perhaps the main reason was that my father had been a factory worker. So had his father, and so had his father. Even as a small child, I wasn't too thrilled about this lackadaisical family trend. I'd been given a glimpse of the factory routine early on when my mother took me to the Fisher Body Plant for a sanctioned visit of my father's workplace. Being that I was from Flint, Michigan, the birthplace of the automobile, I was accustomed to viewing these enormous plants that bulged upon the town landscape, but certainly never from the inside. As I watched my father on that day among a cluster of identical bolts between clusters of identical bins under a cluster of identical beams, I was struck by how insignificant he appeared, how small his hand looked as he raised to wave at us. He was merely one of hundreds of other solemn serfs, perhaps thousands, all wearing brown and all wearing down. No wonder my father never spoke about his job. Exactly what were these guys getting out of this? They were supposed to be building cars, but I couldn't spot a single one. How could a place be so enormous yet so claustrophobic at the same time? There wasn't even a window to be seen. Who the hell forgot the windows? Apart from seeing my father reduced to a less vexing stature, the thing that intrigued me most about the factory was how the assembly line curled, coiled, and wended throughout the plant. It went on and on, seemingly with no real plan. And no matter its course, the workers stuck by its side. They were like busy little appendages on a giant evolving snake. As the process rolled along, they poked at the snake, they pounded on it, they threw fire at it and clipped it with chrome. It was a bit difficult to tell whether they were giving assistance to the snake or trying to assassinate it. I wanted to follow the snake and see what became of it, but our guide broke us away from the line and back to the plant gate. My mother seemed especially glad to be leaving. I couldn't say I blamed her, for even a child clutching his mother's hand could have told you this was an obvious chump's bargain. I was more than confident I'd never be back. On the way to our car, I asked my mother, why were there no windows in there? She turned back toward the factory and studied it. Then she shrugged. There's probably a very good explanation, she said, her voice trailing off without offering one. Naturally, I wound up in the factory too. It turns out that the idealism of youth is a noble little fancy that crumbles fairly easily when introduced to the occupational realities of a gearhead town like Flint. It wasn't so much that no other options existed. It was more a case of pure ancestral gravity taking over, pulling me toward the DNA my clan had smeared from one wretched lever to the next, coaxing me to stick my head down the hole, daring me to resist the snake and its workaday wriggle. However, accepting your birthright is much different from embracing it. This is to say, I didn't get off to a real positive start at GM Truck and Bus. In fact, for the first few weeks, I was certain that I would quit at any given moment. And I don't mean just the job, I mean bow right out of the human race. I found it difficult to get my bearings in a facility that was roughly 200 acres and employed 8,000 people. That sure seemed like a formidable amount of names to memorize for the water cooler routine. The truck and bus plant had its own fire station, its own security force, its own power plant. It even had its own shoe store. Conversely, how many shoe stores had factories inside them? Not many, I would assume. It took me 2 weeks before I could find, with any regularity, my own department. I would arrive at the plant an hour early just to search for my work area. Being a new hire, everything looked perplexingly identical. I couldn't distinguish even the most remote nuance about the place. Walls were walls, wires were wires, girders were girders. D.B. Cooper wasn't dead and Jimmy Hoffa wasn't missing. They probably just worked in here somewhere. Why not simply ask directions, you might ask? Well, are you completely daft? It was bad enough having the neon stigma of new hire emblazoned across my cheeks. To admit to a grizzled shop vet that I was lost and couldn't find my workbench would have been both unholy humiliation and a total career suicide. I might work there another 25 years and still not see an appreciable decline in the jeering quotient, nor the fierce rumors about my erstwhile testicular reduction surgery. I eventually figured out a route, and the key to it was the assembly line itself, the old snake. I would take a stairway, any stairway, up to the line. Once I had the snake in view, I would deduce what stage the truck building process was in by observing parts of the chassis that were either familiar or foreign to me. For instance, I would note if the trucks had doors attached. I knew that when the snake rode through my area, it had no doors. Thus, if I saw doors, this was a signal to backtrack the line instead of following its course. The snake would eventually shed enough unfamiliar items until I wound up in my department. As time went on, I adjusted to the size of the factory. In many ways, I reveled in it. Instead of dreading the prospect of getting lost, I came to invite it. There was something genuinely comforting about disappearing into the gray iron innards of the plant and stumbling upon regions that I'd never seen before. An exhilarating sense of invisibility would embrace me. In my opinion, there were few things as covetous to a nervous man in a gargantuan jungle than the perception that he was effectively indiscernible. Not much could go wrong after that. One of my favorite implant destinations was the final line. Here the trucks were on the verge of completion, beautiful, shiny beasts in single-file splendor, poised to charge to life with an introductory spurt of gasoline. It was a rewarding view when compared to the one I had in cab shop and later on the rivet line. In cab shop, the trucks were still in embryonic form, much like the disappointment I had felt when visiting my father. I couldn't recognize the vehicles as vehicles yet. Visually, I wasn't sure if I was building a truck or a tractor or perhaps a giant toaster oven. I had a real envy for the guys that worked at the end of the final line. It seemed they were able to grab all the glory. Each time a truck would rev to life, one of those lucky suckers got to drive it off into the brilliant Michigan sunshine, heading toward the massive holding lot and ultimately the smitten hearts of the worldwide consumer. Speaking of sunshine, perhaps that was the strongest pull of the final line. Its cavernous opening in the west wall of the factory was the only part of the layout where you could catch any glimpse of the outside world. It was the old enigma of the windows again. What did GM have against transparent glass? Did studies show that workers perform better when deprived of daylight? Was enamel wall paint that much cheaper than Windex? Had those footprints under the sill been traced back to peeping Japanese auto agents? I remember getting nowhere when I asked a couple foremen about it. The disturbing part was that they reacted as if I were bringing up an entirely preposterous matter. One guy told me to utilize the company suggestion box. For a lot of foremen, this was their solution to everything. It's probably how they met their wives and decided what subdivision to nest in. The other foreman was just as useless. "Don't you have better things to worry about, Hamper?" he groaned. Well, apparently so. Within a couple years, I left the factory after a spate of messy breakdowns. There wasn't any one thing that seemed to cause this inglorious bobble of the ancestral baton. I'm fairly certain it wasn't a lack of windows any more than it was a lack of air conditioning or a fear of enormous snakes. Sometimes when your number's up, there isn't any real explanation. Get out and goodbye. I'm no longer in the factory, but a nice chunk still resides in me. That might explain this custom I have when I pay a visit back to Flint. Entering the expressway at Bristol Road, I drive a half mile north. I pull to the side where I-75 begins to intersect with I-69. There's a large hill at this precarious site where I can overlook the guardrail and down upon the back lot of the GM truck and bus facility. And there they are, row upon row of gleaming mid-sized American trucks. immaculately parked butt to butt with their grills reflecting in the sunlight. If I look hard enough and far enough, I can spot the open western wall and see the industrial drip, the latest models charging off the line and out the door. It's still a total wonder to me. And from this vantage point, the sun is always at my back. And that's that. Ooh. Thank you. Water. And let's see. We're going to do another one, and then we'll go to Rivet Head. That's okay. Is that all right? I don't know how many of you are familiar with this fine workers' collection of poems, short stories, sonnets, everything about the working man and woman. It's called Working Words, Punching the Clock and Kicking Out the Jams, and it was edited by my friend M.L. Liebler. And it's just an excellent collection of worker stuff. And I mean, it's thick and huge and groovy. But I highly recommend it. Anyway, I wrote the foreword to this, and I'm really proud to be in here. And we're going to read that. Admittedly, I'm talking about when I start out here, my lifelong, or not lifelong, but for years at the factory, I always envisioned that everybody on the rivet line would just, or the cab shop at that time, burst into song and we would just do a musical. You know, it's like when you watch musicals, you know, people would just be doing some mundane thing and then suddenly they'd be all dancing and step and singing together. And I used to daydream about that all the time, so that's where we're starting. Admittedly, it was an odd vigil, yet one I couldn't abandon. I'd become convinced that one of these days, on one of these vapid, faceless shifts, my line mates would eventually burst into a spontaneous musical number. It would go down just like The Music Man or West Side Story. All I asked was to be on hand. It was one big reason why I rarely missed work. Can you imagine playing hooky on the day that such an event took place? I had nothing but time, so I decided to wait them out. I waited for days, I waited for weeks. When the wait would bore me, I'd do other things. Spot weld, read a newspaper, install a pencil rod, have a smoke. None of us were going anywhere. If need be, I could probably have waited for years. It wasn't like these musical eruptions didn't occur now and then. It happened in Oklahoma. It happened on the west side of New York City. It happened in River City, Iowa, of all places. Documentation does exist. They have countless videos available that you can purchase or rent, all of them showing ordinary folk lunging out of their mundane circumstances and headlong into marvelous song and dance. Beautiful lyrics, sensational stepping, 3 minutes or so of synchronized melodic glee, then right on back to the nothingness of their lackluster now, just like nothing of significance had taken place, as if they had merely taken a break to jiggle a toilet handle or stir a pot of beans. Well, shit, I figured. If it could happen in rural Oklahoma or out in the corn-pone prairies of Iowa, it could just as easily occur right here in the cab shop of the massive GM truck and bus plant in Flint, Michigan. Surely those schmoes from the aforementioned productions didn't have that much of an advantage on us. We had talent, too. For instance, I knew one guy over in Trim who used to play drums for the Box Tops, and the woman on the door latch job sang Supreme songs so gorgeously that grown men were frequently seen using their hankies for something other than dabbing up residual malt liquor beads. I swear even I could carry a tune as well as Rod Steiger, and probably a whole lot better than Paul Lynn. All it was going to take was that first plucky working stiff to jumpstart the number. Some exultant dreg whose monotony meter lolled so deeply into the red that an explosion of artistic impulse might be the last real recourse available. Art born entirely of an heroically pure instinct to find another level, a level of true expression, a level of strenuous survival where something actually happened, if only for 3 minutes. I'd already ruled myself out for this role. After all, this was about spontaneity, and I was already too invested in the whole expectation of the event to be eligible for that. A voyeur's role was to merely observe and experience. That role became rudely compromised if the voyeur attempted to manipulate or assist in the achievement of the action. Of course, I only realized this notion after a few of my own flimsy attempts at spontaneous song imploded on the runway, resulting in nothing more than odd glances from my coworkers. The most dubious failure occurred when I decided to use my spot welder cable as a load-bearing jungle vine and proceeded to hoist myself up on the highline track that ran through our department. Once situated, I launched into some awkward Goulet-esque scat that went something like, "The hills are alive with, fuck, it's so hot in here." My only review came in the form of a verbal reprimand from our dullard supervisor. With me out of the picture, that left approximately 40 good men and women to ignite the musical. At $12.82 an hour, decent dough for the late 70s, I resumed my role as a bored yet well-compensated voyeur. I watched and I waited. I watched and I waited. Every now and then it seemed like it was about to go down. I'd see some guy jump off the MIG welding platform with a brazing rod in his hand and immediately imagine him to be our Harold Hill, baton poised to strike up those 76 trombones. Or I'd look up in the rafters and spot a pipe fitter feeding down new air hose to an air gun, quickly assuming he'd soon take flight and swoop above us like Mary Martin en route to Neverland. It got to the point where a guy couldn't warble along to Iron Man on the radio without me whipping my head out of a wheel well like some skittish art-craving bloodhound. I guess it was just a little over 5 years into my wait when I realized that my line mates just weren't into it. Who knows why? Perhaps they were all under contract somewhere else. I can't say that I was angry with any of them. Maybe I'd been asking too much. Lord knows, attaching doors and truck beds and tailgates to steady-paced body frames was a lot of work unto itself. Didn't leave much time or energy for leaping into song or performing pirouettes or squeezing art from thin, gruesome air. But that didn't mean I quit searching for something. I just tempered my expectations a bit. By the time I transferred down to the rivet line, I was becoming keenly aware that the seeds of art were all around me, something that drifted through the rafters and lurked amongst the bins, poems and elegies, comedies and dramas, tall tales and short stories featuring invisible bylines and universal rights. They may not have had a discernible rhythm to them or assembled anything that would soon be splashed along Broadway, but they were there. They had always been there. It was only a matter of escorting them out of the shadows. I hadn't really written anything since high school, and the only reason I wrote back then was to impress a few hippie girls I knew. Other than that, the whole notion of writing wasn't very attractive. It seemed like a lot of hard work. You had to have something to say, you had to know things, and I didn't know much outside of the fact that it would be nice to have sexual relations with a hippie girl. Perhaps I was still haunted by an earlier failure I'd had with literature. A few years before, my brother Bob and I had decided to write our own Hardy Boy books. Being too poor to buy new volumes and feeling confident that we'd figured out Franklin W. Dixon's winning formula, we hunkered down in our bedroom one summer afternoon, Bob writing on the bed, me at the desk. No doubt about it, this was hard work. Now and then Bob and I would switch spots, remaining speechless, too locked up into our fantastic yarns to disturb the muse. Finally, Bob asked me if I'd take a look at what he'd come up with. His book was titled The Mystery of the Flying Robot. I had to hand it to him. That title sure had a lot of the zing we were after. The text read precisely as follows. Frank and Joe were walking down the street with their girlfriends. Suddenly, they looked up in the sky and saw a flying robot. I reread it and tilted my head and thought, Well, my brother said. I didn't know much about writing, but it occurred to me that Bob may have given away the plot line a bit prematurely. When I mentioned this to him, he became quite irate, demanding to see what I'd come up with. He grabbed my blank sheet of paper and scoffed. At least I came up with something, he said. The whole ordeal left a sour taste in our mouths, and we vowed never to write again. I kept my word for 25 years, until the rivet line presented itself to me, an unlikely muse clumsily disguised as just another indoor meadow of dread and drear. It would come in bursts, quotes, notions, theories, riddles, slammed down on the back of stock tags and paper towels. I'd bring them home in my back pocket and peck out paragraphs on an old typewriter I found in my mom's basement. Suddenly, going to work was no longer this automatic 8-hour death sentence for the soul. There were new considerations. And a daily parade of possibilities. There were leading men and bit players and reoccurring heavies. They still didn't sing or dance in any organized pattern, but that hardly mattered anymore. I couldn't say that writing about my job made assembly line labor appealing, but it did supply me with a purpose, an introduction to another part of me, and most importantly, it gave me something meaningful to do. On a General Motors assembly line, it was crucial to kill time before it had a chance to kill you. I'd seen it happen to members of my own family. That lazy spiral of boredom and regret that often winnowed its way through the whiskey man's till. That pay stub sure looked fine, but it didn't act as much of a salve against one's lack of purpose and placement. I've always felt that work unto itself was only a noble concept in one of those absurd bromides that mothers are fond of reciting. The notion that work builds strong character strikes me as a defeatist consolation, as intrinsically daft as believing bombs build good peace. Like anything else, work is what you make of it. In this way, all workers are artists, sworn to an ingenuity that they must create for themselves. In the words that follow in this collection, we see and feel those who have made their move toward the understanding of work, seeking more than bromides, wanting far more than any pay stub can provide. We move with them. We uphold their struggles, embrace their celebrations. We achieve more. Let's keep moving. Let's want more. Let's see where the work song takes us. Eventually, we'll become the singers and we'll become the dancers that our dreams flung dares at. And that's that. Y'all doing all right? Everybody hear me all right? Okay. By the way, this is my daughter, Sonia, who's featured in the book. And I usually when I do these book readings or interviews, whatever, a lot of times we would, I'd get requests like, whatever happened to your daughter in the book? She sort of just disappears around the first or second chapter, you know, and I'd never really thought of it. And I told Sonia one day, I said, I wasn't conscious of it, but I think I was just protecting you from all the insanity and debauchery that went on in the last 8 chapters of the book. So anyway, this is my daughter, Sonia. Stand up. And now you can read the rest. All right. We'll do a few from Rivethead. How much time do we got here?
Much time as you want.
Oh, well, that's...
I'd say about another 25 minutes.
Okay, all right. All righty. I'm just going to skip around in here. These bookmarks have been in here for a long time. So, let's see. What's this one? Yeah, well, we'll just wing it. Where does this end? Start becoming... Okay, I think I know where that goes. All kinds of arrows and don't do that, don't say that. Just 1 second, one more drink here. This is a part of the book where I'm talking about, and I'm sure it's not... really popular, if it ever was. I mean, it never was with GM, I know for certain, nor the union, but the reality of it was back then there was quite a bit of drinking in the plants. I know they've curbed that a lot, which is probably good, but it was there, you know, a lot, you know, when I worked there in the 70s and 80s, and to say it didn't exist would be a lie. So here's a little... vignette about one specific night where drinking was involved. Me and a buddy going out for a double lunch. Shop rat alcohol consumption was always a hot debate with those who just didn't understand the way things worked inside a GM plant. While not everyone boozed on a daily basis, alcohol was a central part of many of our lives. It was a crutch, not unlike the 20 cups of coffee millions of other Americans depend on to whisk them through their workday. We drank our fair share of coffee, but the factory environment seemed to lend itself towards something that was a great deal more potent and rejuvenating. I frequently found myself defending this custom with non-factory acquaintances. They conveniently put the blame for everything square in the laps of those who drank on the job. No wonder the Japanese are mopping up the market floor with your asses. No wonder my new vehicle farts like a moose full of chickpeas. No wonder the rear end of my Chevy Suburban rattles like a Hare Krishna in a cement mixer. No wonder they want to phase out all you juicers and replace you with robotics. Oftentimes, the Flint Journal would devote large portions of their editorial page to the miserable whines of these blowhards. I worked in the plant for 36 years and never once needed to rely on alcohol. I think that it's an outrage that my neighbor, a GM employee, spends half his shift in a bar. The auto worker of today is weak and corrupt and blah, blah, blah. It's one thing to be harangued by those who've gone before, the forebears, the sit-down strikers, the providers of the torch, my very own grandfather. But to be put through the verbal shredder by townsfolk who've never even seen the innards of an auto factory, well, that was a different matter. Their deductions always made me squirm. The total farce of it all is that given our jobs, these same moany denizens would be lined up right next to us at the bar stools and beer coolers if they could somehow weasel in the gate. They'd lose that sacred work ethic baloney and clasp on to Louis' coveralls. He's a guy that used to sell half pints out of his coveralls. Faster than you can say, the mercury reads 118 in the paint department tonight. Keep in mind, the grass is always greener on the other side until it's your turn to jump the fence and chop the shit down. There's simply no need for apologies. Hell, when you get right down to it, GM management doesn't even pay much heed to the drinking habits of its own workforce. They realize it would be a massive and futile effort on their part to attempt to stymie widespread tradition. And moreover, they really don't give a good goddamn who's tipping and who isn't, just as long as the parts keep flowing by in their assigned locations. Now, if you start sending down inferior product, then the drinking would become an issue. It was during these early years that my old friend Denny and I spent our lunch breaks together. With a double-up arrangement not much different than mine, Denny was able to tag along as we indulged in every shop rat's dream scam, the double lunch. With our jobs securely covered by coworkers, we could slide out and overlap the two lunch periods designated for the two separate truck lines. Instead of a half hour for lunch, we now had a sprawling hour and 12 minutes to get lost. It was wonderful what you could avoid accomplishing with that extra 42 minutes off. One particular double lunch from that period has always stood out. The plant was really roasting that night with the kind of corralled heat that often rendered the overhead fans useless and forced a horde of dehydrated, reeking shop rats to line up at the drinking fountain and gulp down salt tablets. On that night, Denny came to my job with an invitation to slug down a few at lunch. Though nothing in the world sounded better than cold beer, I knew we would have to be careful. The beer was always a godsend going down, but you had to watch out for the fatigue factor it brought on when the heat was this high. If you overdid it, you ran the risk of drowsing out during the second half of the shift. By night's end, you'd be totally gassed and ornery enough to punch out your own grandmother. But the offer was just too appealing. "I like beer," I said. "Beer tastes good." At the convenience store, we stood in line behind three attractive young ladies. They were purchasing Diet Pop and wine coolers. I remember thinking that they must be part of some very special breed, a sorority of angels who simply forbade themselves to perspire. They giggled and fussed with their perfect hair, all the while glaring at us with their terrible animal eyes. We smiled back at them. It was all so hopeless. We couldn't help our appearance. We didn't normally smell this way. It was a $12.82 an hour and the benefits package and the opportunity to swill a cold one in between breaks in the madness that doomed us to trudge into convenience stores looking like Spam patties in wetsuits. Our grandfathers had taken this route. Our fathers were right behind them. Now it was our turn to be thirsty, rank, and every bit as unlucky. We took our quarts of Mickey's malt liquor and headed for the back of the employees' lot. It was always wise to park in a section far, far removed from the roving eye of the surveillance cameras. Otherwise, the guards might scope you down as you tip that cold chalice to your lips and decide to wheel out and give you some shit. This rarely happened, but it was a nuisance all the same. There would be ID requests, there would be boring lectures. Sometimes there might even be a slow shuffle down to the labor relations office. Denny and I drank mostly in silence while a Leslie Gore greatest hits tape poured out of the dash of my Camaro. We were beginning to feel human, the beer working its magic, the edge dissolving, the shop rat's humble version of the multiple martini lunch. We sat there staring off into the smokestacks with the weight of the world gradually sliding through the floorboard. The guards and the bossmen were absolute madmen. How could anything that felt this good be a punishable offense? Our screws were all in place. Our wells were shining brightly. It was all working out. What could be the problem? We both love Leslie Gore, and on this humid, most humid of nights, Les was really letting us have it. California nights, I don't want to be a loser, that's the way boys are, her complete arsenal. We slurped faster and faster on our malt liquor jumbos. At that precise moment, there was little doubt that we had everyone in the galaxy squarely beaten. We were on a roll. We raced back to the convenience store, this time purchasing 2 40-ouncers of Mickey's malt. We hit on the beer and sang along with Leslie and laughed at our great fortune. We looked like trash, we smelled like death, we had no idea who was winning the wars, or the rat race, or the relentless struggle to get on top. It was also very meaningless. Someone would be declared the victor, and the rest of the world would roll over and begin to plot tomorrow's lousy comeback. "I've got to admit," Denny laughed, "it doesn't get much better than this. The whole world's on fire, and here we are, parked in the shadow of this mausoleum, drinking the coldest beer on the planet. With Leslie fucking Gore. No one else on the face of the earth is doing this. No one." "I wonder what Leslie Gore is doing right this minute," I mused. "I wonder what Al Kaline and Roger Smith and Sister Edward Irene are up to right now. Right this very second. I feel sorry for their asses." We laughed until our sides ached. 9:54 returned to the assembly line. Denny and I hustled back to relieve our partners. In the nights to come, we were never really able to recapture whatever it was that led it, to that precious double lunch we spent with Leslie Gore. After a while, we simply quit trying. Perhaps we were just crazy from the heat. It was known to happen. Whatever the cause, we always remembered the night we had you and you and you and the rest of the world thoroughly dicked for 72 minutes. And that'll be the end of that vignette. Well, do you want to hear about how we make them? He's always a popular character. They should have a bar in here. Standing ovation. Yeah, where is that suggestion box? Okay, well, how we make them. I think this is self-explanatory, if it ever could be. Let me just see where the stops and starts and edits. There's so much of this that I wish I could rewrite, but whatever. I was young. It was around this time that we began hearing a strange new entry in the GM vocabulary. The word was quality. The term itself was like some new intoxicating utterance that GM had pried out of the ass end of a golden goose. Quality, quality, quality. Suddenly you couldn't raise your head without having your lobes pummeled with slogans and exhortations hailing this new buzzword. Up until this time, the maxim had always been quantity, quantity and quota. Heard them trucks out the door, quick, quick, quicker. Evidently, GM was finally sniffing the wind. Americans didn't give a shit about how fast and how many units you could zoom out the back door. They just wanted a vehicle that didn't begin to disintegrate the moment it rolled off the showroom floor. If they couldn't find something that held together here, there was always the option of purchasing one of those generic-looking imports that got about 500 miles per gallon and stuck together as firm as Stonehenge. The GM truck and bus plant began fiddling with various quality-minded plots as a means to enthuse the workforce. These concepts range from the build-it-like-you-owned-it guilt trip to the voodoo scare tactics of here come the Japs to foreclose your mortgage to the gimmicky reward the good rodent with a keychain theory. Some of these game plans were so farcical one would have been tempted to guffaw if it weren't for the fact that it was your brain that these follies were being foisted upon. Case in point, the management at the truck plant decided what the quality concept really needed was a mascot. Conceived in a moment of sheer visionary enlightenment, the plan was to dress up the mascot as a large cat. True. Fittingly, this rat in cat's clothing was to be called Quality Cat. Somewhere along the line, an even more brilliant mind upstairs decided that Quality Cat was sort of a dull title. Therefore, a contest was organized in an attempt to give the Quality Cat a more vital name. Hundreds of crafty welders, screw jockeys, and assorted shop rats immediately began clunking their heads in an effort to christen the hollowed cat. Management announced that they would reward the most creative of these entries with a week's use of a company truck. Hot damn. The eventual winner of the contest was a worker who stumbled upon this inspired moniker, How We Make 'Em. Sadly, my intriguing entry, Wanda Quit, finished way the hell down the line, somewhere right between Roger's pussy and Tuna Me Out. How We Make 'Em was to become the messianic embodiment of the company's new quality drive, a living, breathing propaganda vessel assigned to spur on the troops. Just for a moment, go ahead and laugh. Hang on here. Go ahead and laugh. I know I did laugh. Just for a moment, imagine the probing skull session that took place in some high-level think tank the day Howie was first brought to mention. You know, slogans on coffee cups just ain't getting it, Bill. You're absolutely right, Ted. We need something more dynamic, more upbeat. Hey, why don't we give the men their own kitty cat? Kitty cat. I like it. A large kitty cat. Ted, you're a genius. Howie Makem stood 5'9". He had light brown fur, long synthetic whiskers, and a head the size of a Datsun. He wore a long red cape emblazoned with the letter Q for quality. A very magical cat, Howie walked everywhere on his hind paws. Cruelly, Howie was not entrusted with a dick. Howie would make the rounds, poking his floppy whiskers in and out of each department. A Howie sighting was always cause for great fanfare. The workers would scream and holler and jump up and down on their workbenches whenever Howie drifted by. Howie Makem may have begun as just another company ploy to prod the tired legions, but most of us ran with the joke, and soon Howie evolved into a crazy phenomenon. Of course, that isn't to say that everyone was in Howie's corner. Opinions varied. For instance, Dave Steele hated Howie's guts. He insisted that having a giant cat parade around the factory, espousing GM dogma, insulted his intelligence and demeaned him personally on an adult level. I remember we constantly argued about Howie's existence. One night, Dave had really had it with Howie. "Christ, what's next?" he groaned. "They'll probably bring in Fred Rogers to pass out balloons and lollipops." "Chill out," I laughed. "You're taking all this shit way too serious. Sure, having a giant cat rooting us on is a little bit ludicrous, but you have to admit the concept is at least humorous in a pathetic kind of way." Dave bristled. "I don't find anything the least bit humorous about having some suck-ass in a cat's costume roaming through my place of work. What they are telling us is that we are so retarded growth-wise that we can only relate to characters along the lines of Saturday morning cartoon figures. Bring out Bozo, hail Huckleberry Hound. Who would you prefer, Einstein and Edison? Face it, Howie fits these surroundings." "Fuck Howie, fuck Einstein and Edison. What do I need this mascot bullshit for? Do they really think I'll perform a better job with a huge cat lurching over me? If they really want to charge up all these boneheads, why not bring in some Playboy bunnies? I'm 30 years old, not 13. On the other hand, my editor at the Flint Voice loved hearing about Howie Makem. I can't remember anything that made him laugh harder. He'd double over and clutch his stomach, tears running down his cheeks. Plainly, this was the most hysterical gag Michael Moore had ever heard of. The best part about it was that I didn't have to make up a single word. Everything that I told him regarding Howie was pure fact. I remember the first time I told Mike about Howie. "You mean to tell me," Moore sputtered between assorted snorts and cackles, "that GM has a guy who walks around the factory dressed up like a giant cat? This is their idea of enticing quality from their workforce?" "Correct," I replied. "Oh my God, oh shit," Moore squealed. "You know what this means, don't you? The end of Western civilization, a communist overthrow? No, no, no. You have to get an interview with Howie Makem for the paper. The Rivethead meets the quality cat." "Not a fucking chance," I howled. "I'll write you a biography of Howie. I'll put together a Howie Makem diary. I'll interview workers on their feelings about Howie, but I absolutely refuse to talk with that cat thing. Not now or ever. Jesus, who knows what lurks inside that giant furry head?" Moore kept pestering me to do an interview with Howie, and I held firm. The answer was and always would be no, a definite no. Just watching Howie trudge by my job waving his big brown paw in my direction was freaky enough. Having to sit down and ask him questions would have sent me right over the wall. Still, Moore never gave up hope. He pleaded with me every time I went out to the Voice for passages from Howie. It became a very large nuisance. Alas, the matter resolved in a strange way. Tragedy had apparently struck. Weeks and then months went by without a single Howie sighting. Everyone at work was puzzled. Had Howie been promoted to the front office? Had Howie transferred to the day shift? Had Howie been kidnapped by Japanese invaders? Worse yet, had Howie Makem, the official ambassador of GM's new quality push, been unceremoniously laid off? Had it been in the U.S. News and World Report? Quote, the working class the world over is in shock today as it was announced that the General Motors Corporation's beloved quality cat, Mr. Howard Makem, was officially laid off from his job at the GM truck and bus facility in Flint, Michigan. A grieving UAW spokesman told reporters, the auto industry has lost a dear comrade and a special brother who provided a keen light in an era of darkness. GM Chairman Roger Smith refused comment outside of the admission that he felt like, quote unquote, felt like a lousy hangman, end quote. Mr. Makem is reported to be in seclusion at his home outside the small village of Lapeer, where a night-long vigil is being held by throngs of admirers and somber line mates. I remember the day I had to break the news to Mike that Howie Makem had apparently vanished. Christ, it was as if I told him his little brother had disappeared. Howie's gone, Mike hollered. Have you asked around? He must be somewhere. I don't know where he went. All I know is that he's been missing for weeks. The flag outside the plant hasn't been lowered, so I assume he's still alive. You wouldn't be snowing me on this whole disappearance, would you? Moore said. I know how loath you are to giving me a Howie Makem interview. Let's be honest. I can't believe we're having this whole conversation. Howie Makem is missing. I don't know why. I don't know where. Above all, I don't fucking care. If he ever shows up again, I promise I'll get you an interview. Are you happy? My editor leaned back in his chair. Exceedingly so, he beamed. It was back to the drawing board for the brainy sorts at GM Truck and Bus. In light of Howie's disappearance, another inventive quality concept was needed. They introduced us to the official GM quality drinking glass. One evening, the supervisors began approaching each of their workers with a little mid-job pep talk. The gist was that if the quality level reached such and such a figure, we would all receive a lovely drinking glass memento that we could proudly take home to show our kin and prop beside our bowling trophies and eighth grade diplomas. The glass even provided wrenching of the heartstrings, for emblazoned on the side of the was the profile of none other than Howie Makem himself. Rest his controversial soul. Christ, I got all choked up and thought I was going to bawl. With renewed determination, I began knocking the piss right out of each and every rivet that dared rear its shiny scalp in my direction. Forget your house payment, forget your child support, forget that trip to Cedar Point. Damn it, do it for Howie. Sure enough, the boys and I hit our goal. One night after lunch break, Gino came lugging a case of quality drinking glasses down the line. Thanks for the good job, Ben, Gino smiled. Here's your cup. At the same time, one of the utility guys was walking right behind Gino, asking each worker whether he'd like to sell his quality glass for a buck. He mumbled something about wanting to start a collection. I was shocked. I told the guy to get his rotten currency out of my face. No one could have my Howie Makem drinking glass. The gall of some bastards. I figured that the whole investment in these glasses probably ran GM about $35. But of course, it was the thought that mattered most. After all, when someone works hard all day in a smoky chamber full of sludge, noise, armpits, beer breaths, cigar butts, psychos, manic depressives, grease pits, banana stickers, venom, and gigantic stalking kitty cats, why not give the guy his own glass? You can bet your ass he'll soon be needing a drink.
Thank you.
So, hopefully you've got questions and comments. We've got a microphone in John Shaw's hand. And what we're going to do is you're going to raise your hands, and he'll make sure he gets the mic around to you. But I want to point out that we have someone from Schuler's who has a baker dozen copies of Rivethead way in the back. There's Rhoda. And so,
hi, Rhoda.
If you're interested,
Facebook friend.
If you're interested in a copy that maybe you can get Ben to sign at the end of tonight's reading, that would be great. But at this time, what I'd like to do is have you raise your hands if you have comments or questions for Ben. And there we go. Susan.
Hi, Ben. I'm glad you're here. My name's Susan Schmidt. I had a dad that spent 45 and a half years on the line in Moraine, Ohio.
Wow.
Harrison Radiator. I read your book many years ago. I'm going to have to pull it out again now and enjoy it again. What kind of pushback did you get from union workers when some of this, when the book was written? Or did you get any?
Well, like feedback from them?
Well, whenever you tell the real stories, I mean, it depicted some of the workers. I mean, my dad came home and would complain about some of the young punks that drank, and it was very upsetting to him. And for people to portray maybe more of the workers that were like that than the people like him who were trying to put kids through college. So.
Well, I didn't hear much of that, but that's probably because I was one of those young punks and hung around with young punks at the time. But, I mean, from the people I talked to, I never really got a negative thing. I mean, I would hear about it from, you know, like second parties. Like, you know, I got the book from my dad, and he thought it was total bullshit. But, I mean, one of the things about the book is, like, when I started doing the columns, Moore convinced me to start these columns for the Voice. And I just said to myself, there can't be any holding back or, like, secrets. It's like, if I'm going to do this, it's got to be, you know, everything, the drinking and the, you know, just, you know, unflattering stuff. So I never concerned myself with the any backlash about it because I just felt I had the truth on my side. I mean, you might not agree with it or what people were up to in the plant, and that's fine, but as far as the reporting, it was accurate.
Are we live? Hey, Brian Stratton. I read your book in my 13th or 14th year of bank operations. I did not make it to year 15. I'd had enough of the suits gobbling up one bank after another, maybe 10 branches at a time. And then they were going to merge with a large New York bank, which would essentially double our workload. And when we inquired about any more cash for us, well, be patient. My patience ended. It was very inspirational work. I just, do you ever think about adapting it for the stage? reason being, because
just in that one article there. No.
Oh, yeah. There's,
the movie rights have been sold a couple times, but it's yet to be made.
It keeps...
We came close about 10 years ago with Richard Linklater bought the rights and wrote a really nice script the second time it sold. And him and Matt Dillon, who wanted to play me, came to Flint for 2 days. But nothing much was achieved out of that except two massive hangovers. Three, actually. We went around and saw shop bars and talked about it. But he didn't get the funding he needed or whatever. So it's still out there if anybody wants to make a movie here.
Okay, so raise your hands if you'd like to ask a question or have a comment. Other questions or comments?
All right. So it's very interesting. I don't know if you remember Ortonville, but I've just moved to East Lansing from Ortonville, which is only 10 or 15 miles from the plant you described, and I know that area very well. Anyway, I wondered... Picking up on the earlier question, did you ever get any attempts or face any attempts from GM to squelch the comment? I mean, the fact that it was all true is all well and good, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to allow it to be made public.
No, I think their general rule on something like that is just pretend it doesn't exist. And I never heard any direct, you know, reaction from them. I think the only reaction they ever gave was in a People magazine article that came out right after the book came out. And I remember it was something to the effect that Mr. Hamper doesn't represent the thousands of hardworking General Motors employees that we have, which I sort of took offense to because I didn't do it by the rule book, but I was hardworking. But a couple foremen would make snide remarks and sort of, but by and large, I had pretty good relations with my supervisors at work. I always remind people that I wasn't at war with those people or any necessarily the corporation or anything. I had one foe day in, day out, and that was it right there. That was the battle that I went to. And every day, that's what, we do. GM was paying us a lot of money. I mean, I thought it was a good bargain, the issue wasn't really there. Of course, stuff like Howie Makem and stuff was pretty stupid and silly and ripe for, making fun of. But yeah, that was the adversary right there, We just did battle every day with the clock and how we could move it along.
Okay, we've got another question back here. Yes, I read Rivethead maybe back probably shortly after it came out, and I was working, I think, in Lapeer at the time, so I wasn't that far from Flint. I've been a distance runner for a good portion of my life, and more recently, I do long bike tours and whatever, and I certainly experienced what they call the runner's high. You could call the same thing the biker's high. I've heard women talk about a knitting high. with this repetitious kind of thing. And when I read your section about
the Olympics,
you became the riveter.
Yeah.
You became the rivet. And it made me think he's felt that same high that I have felt, that you can't go out and seek. It just kind of happens. Am I right in that?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're referring to, what section. And after I worked up in Cab Shop for like 5 years, and I never really hit my stride up there and figured it all out. I didn't do any writing really up there. It wasn't until I got to the rivet line, and then there was something about the rivets, and after I got used to it and the feel of that rivet gun, that after a while I took a lot of pride in it. I just realized, as mundane and, useless as this skill might be anywhere else out on the street, I just felt like I had become like the James Brown of the rivet gun, or the Mickey Mantle of the rivet gun or something. And it just, then I would play these games in my head that would pass along, the time where, I was in the Olympics, and I keep trying to beat my time, with obviously a mind on quality and getting everything right. Just like an Olympic gymnast would be judged. And I really did. And that's where I, ordained myself the rivet head. And from that point on, that's about the time that I met Moore, and he sort of talked me into writing a weekly column on it, and then just unfolded from there. But, I really identified with that image. And it wasn't anything really special, but it was special to me because it's what I had to do every day.
Yeah, is anyone ever going to hear the Chopra?
Oh, the Chopra. No, well, there actually a few songs exist on a couple of cruddy CDs of our band, but outside of that, I don't think that will be released in any large scale amount. He's referring to the shop opera that me and Dave Steele, who was mentioned in one of those vignettes, we're going to write like a Tommy. But it was going to be about it was going to be called No Need for the Grievance Procedure.
What Michigan writers do you enjoy reading?
Well, I think who was I? Bill, who did, is Bill here? Yeah, there's Bill. Did the article in the paper. We were talking about Jim Harrison is a big okay. Is probably my favorite writer. I really enjoy his stuff and. Mm-hmm. Got to meet him. I live close to where he used to live, up in Leelanau County. And I admire his stuff, his poetry, and his novels.
Hi, I'm from Flint, right down the road from Truck and Bus. Have you been back recently?
Have I been back there?
Yeah.
I was there today.
That's
where I came from.
from when you worked there to now, I mean, you hear about a lot about Flint in the media nowadays about how we're the most dangerous city in the world and everything. We have the highest crime rate. Has it changed in your opinion?
Yeah, it's certainly a lot more desperate than when I lived there 20 years ago. It's just, you know, eroded, and it is, you know, sadly very crime-ridden and desolate in a lot of areas. You know, I mean, there's still a good spirit there, but there's no sense denying it. It's a rough town, and so many of these good jobs left, and a lot of people just haven't had that kind of income to turn to, and unfortunately have made, some of them made improper choices as far as what they're doing, you know, and thus a lot of crime and a lot of depression and devastation.
How long has it been since you've been in a GM plant?
Where's that coming from? Oh.
How long has it been since you've been in a plant?
The last time I was in the plant was the day mentioned right at the end of Rivethead.
You ever miss it?
Actually, yes. I mean, I'd say I missed the plant, so to speak, but I certainly missed the camaraderie of all the people I hung out with there. And you know, like I mentioned in that one vignette about, I mean, I really did get inspiration, you know. It really, as you probably, most of you are aware, I've hardly been a prolific writer after that. I mean, the Rivet Line, it was sort of like on my job description. It was part of the job for me to write on that. And when I left there, I sort of, my muse sort of disappeared with it. I just have never rekindled the interest, you know. And frankly, I'd just rather not write than write something that was only half sincere. And I've never encountered anything. Of course, I lead a real dullard's existence, but I mean, who wants me to write about my, you know, favorite records or my fantasy baseball team? You know, so.
Okay, at the end of the book, you said that you felt kind of lucky or somewhat. Like, why? Like, why did you feel lucky?
I think I just meant that as, I think if I, as the book ends, I'm like walking out of there. I went back to visit like some workers, and they kept working. But I left, and I knew I had that option. I guess that I think that's what I meant by that. It's like, well, at least I'm not in this anymore. I really didn't want to leave, but it just got so bad with these panic attacks I would have, and the agoraphobia. You know, I talk about those windows and stuff, sort of joke about it, but that stuff ended up getting to me. I just, it got to where I would, you know, start to, like, almost pass out thinking about it. And I try not to think about it. And then I'd think about how, you know, close we were all together. And it just, like, I gave it a foot in the door, and it just took over. I just couldn't get it. And I was taking more and more medication, either, you know, through my doctors, and then I was self-medicating with alcohol a lot right at the end. And it just was becoming plain dangerous for me to be able to stay in there. I'd have to be so whacked out, like have so many of these like downers in my system and alcohol that it, I mean, it just was very unattractive at the end. You know, it was embarrassing. Down in Pontiac, I'm, it wasn't anything I'd be proud of or anything. And it just, I wish it never happened. I could have seen doing my dirty there, but I just couldn't make it.
I grew up just outside of Flint. And I actually can connect to the book. When we were young, we went over to one tough man contest, and it was pretty brutal. And I, when you were describing it, I had the same thoughts in my head when I went with my friends. My dad took me, and I just thought it was funny. Have you ever been back since to another tough man?
No, that was another one of Michael Moore's. If I remember right, Michael Moore's brain schemes. This was before I think I started writing about the factory solely. And Moore was always trying to get me to places where, like, bizarre things, sort of Flintoidish things were going on. And I remember, like, an Elvis impersonator out at the Russellville Ballroom and just weird stuff like that. He set me up on a blind date. We went to a rock and roll bar, and I was supposed to write about that. But that was one of them, the Tough Man contest. And no, I didn't enjoy myself and never went again.
We're going to take one more question.
Let's get this gentleman here. He's had his hand up the whole.
Thank you. I work in a shop in Lansing and then had the pleasure of coming back and teaching some college courses to foremen and general foremen at the plant. And we discussed, this is in the 70s, and we discussed some of the problems. And then they looked me in the eye and they said, the only problem with the people in the plant are the guys your age, just like you, you know. And would you agree with that, or do you think the soul-deadening aspects cut across ages and such, or do you think the 60s, 70s generation was especially problematic for the corporation?
I would hazard a guess, yes. I mean, like when I hired in the 70s, the union was tremendously strong, and in the 60s, too. I was before my time, but anytime you have a situation like that, then, you know, we were... you know, we took advantage of the fact that when I worked there, I mean, I saw a guy get knifed in the neck and he only got 2 weeks off. I mean, where else? I guess what I'm saying is you could get away with a lot. And it was a lot like Hogan's Heroes, you know. And it's like, well, the more they let us get away with, we're going to take it, you know. But as far as your question about age, I think... You know, I'm much older. When this book, you know, the hijinks, I was sort of like in my late 20s, maybe early 30s. And obviously a lot different person than I am now. And that went for all of us guys. You know, I saw more of that. I always work second shift, and usually the young guys would be on second shift. And the times I would get, like, sent to first shift for a week or something, I noticed an appreciable difference. And so I think there is some credence to the fact that, number one, I think family guys acted a lot more mature and stuff. But most of us guys in second shift were single. And, I mean, we basically just took it like Animal House or something, whatever we could get away with. It's like, look, if we can pull off these scams and be over at the bar drinking on the clock, we'll do it, you know. And, I mean, I know that sounds terrible, but like I say, if you were in the same spot, you'd probably do it. And I might add, I talk to people that are still there. There's not too much of that going on anymore. And I'm amazingly sorry if I put the kibosh to that. had any doing with it.
Let's all give Ben one more round of applause, please.